Welcome to our first conversation, our water cooler conversations in healthcare AI. We're doing this from the perspective of two Stanford faculty members, physicians, who are trying to find our way for what's happening next in healthcare and how AI is going to change the field. Matt's the chief scientific officer for Microsoft in healthcare, in addition to his Stanford faculty role. And I'm Justin Norden, CEO and founder of a company called Qualified Health. And also, we teach together a course on generative AI and medicine at Stanford. The purpose of this discussion here is these are conversations we've had for the past years trying to figure out what's coming next. And especially with the pace of development, what's happening in the field, the news and articles and research is changing by the week. And when we were asked by Stanford to put this together a little bit more broadly, we said, okay, we'll record ourselves having these conversations and bring some of our, best friends and people across the space. And so today, to kick off our inaugural episode, we'll have Troy Tasbaz, who recently was leading digital health for the FDA. So we're going to cover a handful of current topics. We'll pull up some data. We'll see where the conversation goes. And as a note, these conversations are our personal opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Stanford or any of our companies or organizations that we're a part of. So to kick things off, we wanted to start with like where are we at now in the healthcare AI landscape? And I want to pull up one chart, and then Matt, I'll turn to you to kind of explain what we're looking at a little bit here on what's coming next, on what we see right now for effects of using these tools since the launch, and kind of where people are getting some gains.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a great paper just from the past week, and really starts to show, despite those of us who've been tracking this very closely for at least a couple of years, as generative AI started to permeate through kind of just the general workforce, we always knew that people were kind of using the models. I think we saw a lot of usage. I think people would talk about it, but maybe they wouldn't even surface that they were using it. I think Ethan Mollick had that great blog talking about the secret cyborg, right? People were getting some work done, but they weren't like asking for more work, right? So that was kind of a phenomenon. But this has been, this is maybe one of the best recent papers kind of looking at, okay, let's actually break down all the different knowledge work tasks and actually see what the difference is leveraging, the best new model to complete their tasks and how much time they're saving. And I mean, the takeaway here, again, I think with some of the caveats that this is very, specifically designed to look for this, but tripling productivity for knowledge work tasks across the economy is a pretty eye-popping result to me. And I think the other thing that I took away from this was how many people were using it, and really have only come around to using it in maybe in the last 6 months. And I sort of feel like, of course everyone's using it, right? But I think it's still kind of slowly making its way. And then of course, brings me to the healthcare. And thinking about maybe just the only study I've seen, which is the British Medical Journal study that talked about, the GPs that they surveyed, or how many are using it in their practice. So I think it raises a lot of interesting questions. But it's definitely starting to paint this pattern that as the tools get better, people are adopting them and absolutely saving time, no matter what they do for a living.
Yeah, and just for everyone, the GP study from the British Medical Journal showed, I think it was last year, 20% of GPs are using these tools on a at least weekly basis and for clinical care, not just in general or writing emails, et cetera, which is pretty astounding. And I'll pull up one more thing, and then Troy, I want to see what you hear on this. But what's fascinating is that's the backdrop of what's happening generally in AI. This was a study done by HIMSS. They released end of December, just a survey. And most people or most medical workplaces don't have access to these chatbots or any training related to AI. Many of them are restricted from using AI at work. And so it's this weird like moment in time where at least many people are using these tools at work. At least in healthcare, many people aren't supposed to be using these tools at work, or don't have access to these tools. And so, I had a funny conversation with a head of a healthcare organization to me, nameless, who was like, hey, do people have access to tools like ChatGPT? And it's like, oh yeah, everyone has their phone. Which hopefully doesn't scare Troy too much as a regulator and worried about HIPAA and data violations and
Well,
things
I'm
like
no
that.
longer the regulator, so you know.
Well, I don't know
Use it you want now.
Oh, what do you make of this, Troy? Like, how do we put these pieces together?
You know, this is an interesting I between the two charts, right? In my previous role before going to the government and then now back to a similar role, we used to do this study to ensure that you know our development investments were appropriately you know prioritized. And one thing that we looked at was like IT spend as a percentage of the revenue of an industry. And one thing that was quite evident is that healthcare tends to be on the lower end of that, and which means that when it comes to technology, technology investments, technology adoptions, it trails some of the other industries that go on. So frankly, I think the this maybe speaks to that. And the question now becomes, is the lack of use because there's just not enough maybe approved technology available in healthcare, or is it more of a systematic problem around whether we're teaching this stuff in medical school? As two people who both gone through medical school but also teach at a medical school, you know, one fundamental truth exists, which is it's still new. Like being a medical professional is such a knowledge worker. It's all about the knowledge, right? And so I think that maybe perhaps tradition is playing into also some of this lack of adoption. So I think it's always going to be fundamentally probably two prongs, which is, are the tools really available and are they healthcare centric? And second of all, are we actually ensuring that the next generation medical professionals are coming up with, you know, you, they have an understanding of how to use these tools in their day-to-day, you know, process of delivering care.
Yeah. And
I
I think
agree with you.
what's
Let me interject there because I fundamentally agree that I think at the top-down approach that we typically take to the health enterprise software, training, like, you know, ensuring ROI, all those things come into play. I feel like we're seeing a bottoms up though, don't you agree? Like, you know, everyone's got a phone, right? Everyone's using it most likely in their day-to-day. And those that have used it and experimented with it maybe even 6 months ago, a year ago, may have dismissed it because of a flaw or a hallucination, whatever the issue was. And maybe they haven't been keeping pace with what's actually changing. And because it is so fast, it's more like a river than a lake to me. And every time you look at it, it's different. And you know, those that aren't really keeping up aren't really getting that those turns at bat to get the experience to be able to leverage it more. I struggle with this, right? Because like you know, there are institutions like Stanford and UCSF and others out there that have set up enterprise, you know, HIPAA compliant instances of these models for their workforce to allow them to, you know, to start to explore and in a very bottoms up way. But you know, at the end of the day, like I struggle with trying to how does this fit into the sort of traditional healthcare SaaS box, you know, for all the different use cases it's powerful for. I don't know, like I don't have an answer, but this part of me feels like the pragmatist or the realist or the fatalist in me, whatever, sort of feels like they're just going to find a way to use it if you aren't able to make it available to everyone. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, and the reason in my head is like these tools, like this is the ChatGPT, right? And actually, there's an interesting graph that we can pull up later off, like different usage from the same study we just looked at. This is the fastest growing consumer piece of technology ever, right? And this is marketed to consumers. They're pushing, there's all these companies competing, pushing the pace. And it's so good that it's coming in a, you know, bottoms up way to healthcare. And like we saw this before in healthcare. We saw this with like social networks and people figuring out like posting healthcare information, and institutions freaked out as people are posting information and pictures on social media. So we've had a few like early starts of seeing technology seep in like consumer first into healthcare institutions. And this is just the next iteration of that. I think what's potentially different is the speed at which it's happening and the utility. At least from that, I'm candidly, I don't believe all those 3x graphs. That's a little bit too bright for me. I get improvements. Yeah, all is fine. But it's useful.
Here's what I'll also say about, I think, this technology in general, about the whole bottoms up versus tops down type of thing, right? I mean, if you look at what happened with generative AI, right? I mean, particularly once ChatGPT-4 came out, is that, they go, okay, here's this great new capability. Where could we apply it to? That's a very bottoms up approach kind of technological adoption strategy, right? It wasn't like, hey, here are the problems that we're trying to solve for whatever the industry might be, and here are the tools available, and generative AI just happens to be yet another tool for that. And I think so. I think by just the how the technology was integrated into, society, and or how it's being integrated into society, was very bottoms up. The other thing that I'll also say, and you two know this a whole lot more than I do, but healthcare system, especially in the United States, is a highly fragmented anyway, right? I mean, and so which means that any change, any improvements, any progress really gets done at the bot from a bottoms as well. And so, when I was kind of wearing a regulator's hat, I always kind of used to work with all the hospital systems and say, instead of have the technology providers come to you and say, here's what we'd like you to integrate, why are you not all coming together and say, these are all the problems that we're all trying to address that are consistent across, whether it's a large hospital system, an AMC, or a community center. And I think that type of you have to flip the switch a little bit and say that the hospital systems and the healthcare, I guess, ecosystem has to be essentially providing the demand signal to say, hey, technology providers, these are the issues that we need to address and the priority we need to address them in.
I really like that comment because that I think is what we're starting to see. I think they're I don't know if we have the paper, Justin, or not, but we can maybe put it in the notes. But some institutions have said now that we've implemented this sort of HIPAA compliant way to leverage the models for whatever use case across the enterprise. Now we can actually look at a bird's eye view and say, well, what are they using it for, and who's using it for what? And then that really does start to your point, like get, boil down the things that it's actually having an impact for in a very organic way. And they allow them to say, well, do I want to operationalize that as, or do I want to look for a vendor for that? Or do I just want to have folks share best practices and their prompts, and maybe even have, like, sort of prompt workflows already baked in? I mean, I really feel like this is still a very early days. The part that I struggle with still, though, is that, we kind of make decisions around where the capabilities are with a snapshot in time again. But I feel like it's like, again, taking a picture of a movie or something. Like, it's like you're gonna look again, it's gonna be a totally different thing going on. And it's gonna be like, oh, does that change everything? And that makes it so challenging, right? It's a moving target.
Matt,
Yeah.
you got to talk about this then, at least on the performance curve that you're talking
Well, I
about.
mean, this is just one of many, and I'm sure, folks in the audience have seen a ton of these, and I, you know, I, there's literally several dozen, right? So there's benchmarks that, folks have for a long time felt are going to be very, very difficult, for models. And as soon as you hear someone say, I've created a new benchmark, it's going to be years before AI solves it. And then, like, without question, 3 or 4 months later, you'll see one of these exponential curve graphs. And I think, if I'm being honest, I think over the course of maybe the last, 4 or 5 months, since we really kind of started to understand, test time compute inference scaling on essentially letting the model think, quote unquote, there really doesn't seem to be a lot of benchmarks left that we aren't saturating to the point where, any further, reference to them is almost not very useful. I still feel, and this is especially true in medicine, that there's a disconnect between some of the benchmark that at least we use for healthcare broadly. MedQA is obviously one, and actually the performance on specific real good, use cases that will actually drive impact. But nonetheless, to me, it still is a signal, I think, and maybe a call to action. Because what I would like to see is, and again, I love the GPQA, I love the SWA Bench Verified, I love all these benchmarks. Where are benchmarks in healthcare of similar things for tasks that we actually really do think are hard to solve, but are really important. And then I would love to see a bunch of these curves doing that for those too. You know what I mean? And that's the one thing I'm a little jealous, if I'm being honest. I kind of look at these, I mean, man, coders, you know, they're killing it, right? It's like, what do they say now? Sam recently said what O3 is, you know, amongst the top, whatever, 150 coders in the world or something like that. Like, I would love to have a model that is, you know, top position in whatever specialty, with a really good benchmark to prove that out.
Well, people are trying to talk about this with O1 and case management tasks for things like this, where it keeps getting better and better. And Jonathan Chen, one of our Stanford faculty, has been putting out paper after paper of, hey, actually, we all thought AI plus, humans would be better than just AI or humans. And actually, we're finding, at least on the benchmarks currently that we're talking about and testing against, AI on its own is doing better without human and physician interaction. And so how do we make sense of that? Are the benchmarks correct? Are they right? I guess the flip side of that is, do we even need those benchmarks anymore, Matt? Like, the AI is winning.
It's very hard for me to wrap my head around this because, like, you know, I've been doing health AI, right? Building models for like what, over 10 years, of all different shapes and sizes. And every time I'm on a panel or I'm talking to a class, it's always like AI plus human is going to be better than, you know, human or AI alone. I can't, it's actually like it's great ingrained into me, that mentality. And I cannot find a really well done study that shows that, right? Instead, I see studies like the one you're showing here, which is that these models do really well on their own, and they do better on their own than physicians using the model. Now, I don't know. I'm sure there's some aspect of human computer interaction. There's some aspect of the benchmark itself, like, you know, and there's probably an aspect of just like learning the familiarity. I think all of us know it takes a while to start to understand how to use these models effectively, et cetera. But it still doesn't change the fact to me here, where I'm begging the community to prove me right. Otherwise, I have to go back and like correct so many statements where, you know, I was convinced that AI plus physicians was going to be better than either one alone. I don't know. I mean, Troy, I don't know if you have a take on this,
And
because
I want to know
you're elaborate.
your like regulatory take too, or like how we're like we've always been in that paradigm, but then we're kind of seeing data differently. Like, how are you thinking about this?
Well, I think it's really hard to determine what is it that are at. I mean, like, kind of looking at this particular chart and then having this conversation, it's like, is it better at just being a physician, or is it very, very specific tasks that it does actually better, right? So I think without that context, it's kind of hard. And I think these are also, in my opinion, I don't want to say they're dangerous, but it's more of a it's missing the point, right? I mean, the point is that, and I've said this before, and we've talked about this before. It's like, if you start kind of pitting AI against, let's say, some sort of a field, and in this case, it's medical professionals, what do you think the adoption curve is going to be, right? Right. And maybe that's why the previous chart actually says what it says. And so I think the question or the dialogue should really be is that where can we apply this that it's going to perform better than a human and for various reasons, where the human can then focus on the things that AI can't do, right? Or it could solve for the huge labor shortage problem. It's like I think the narrative when I see these types of studies, it to me it's very academic. It's not, in my opinion, real in a sense that it's not solving the problem, right? Sure, it's the analogy that I use often, where it's like, you know, you could put a Ferrari on rush hour traffic on 101, and is it going to perform better than something else? No, probably you're going to get to from point A to point B at the exact same time, but you just spend another 200 something thousand dollars more getting there. And so I think the narrative needs to change, that we need to stop comparing the two. We need to say that where is it applicable, Where can we apply it to that is going to be beneficial for both the people who are working in the healthcare field, but also the patients, which is the ultimate, you know, goal here. And I think that's why most, you know, medical professionals got into the profession to begin with. You know, from a regulation, well, I mean, I actually would love to hear from your point of view because, you know, both of you are physicians. One of you really are practicing. And so, exactly. And so the question for you all is like, how do you feel about this stuff?
I'll give a comment from a medical student.
A real physician versus
in a class together. No, which was, hey, you just asked this very simple question of like, Professor Norden, you know, historically, you know, doctors had all this knowledge that were unique in their head. And we would have this conversation and build that trusted relationship with the patient where there was a lot of knowledge transfer happening in interaction. It's like watching the fields and things we're talking about in class, our patients are going to come in knowing more because they spent 2 hours going through every part of their disease and what's happening than we are. Like, what is our role? And so like, just like those questions, as you start to answer, at least for the medical knowledge answering tasks, like the AI is better today. But then it's like, what is that role question? And that's where I'll tee you up, Matt, with how you want to take that now as you're practicing today.
But I mean, I live in kind of two, it's like, you know, yes. Like I still walk by a fax machine at work. I still like sometimes pause and reflect on what I actually do in a clinical day. And I think about what I used to do when I started and how different it looks in terms of the number of things that, you know, every couple of years there's a new thing or a new form or a new process or whatever. And that it's just like we've got this huge multi-layered, you know, onion that we have to peel back, right, to sort of stop the bleeding, I think, in the healthcare workforce. And so to Troy's point, yeah, the benchmarks are telling one story, but the reality on the ground is I will take anything that will help me peel back that onion and get me back to taking care of patients the way I want, you know, the way I was trained to do, the reason I went into healthcare, you know. And I think, you know, we've seen some of that, right? There's some solutions that are purpose built for a, to solve a problem, and it doesn't lead with quote AI, right? They're like the ambient nodes, I think, is a great example. There's a bunch of these out there, and they're changing the game. I think they're having a real impact, partially. And again, it sounds like a simple solution, but it's a real problem. I mean, you know, how much time folks spend on, you know, administrative note taking. And there's so many more, I think, that are low hanging fruit. On the other hand, when I see these kinds of, you know, to Justin's point, that, you know, a patient can spend a couple hours with the model and, you know, in theory, again, ignoring some of the challenges there, walk away with a pretty good download of the concepts and principles of their disease or whatever their condition is. I mean, that to me, to take your analogy, Troy, of a Ferrari on a freeway, now I'm looking at, is that actually not a Ferrari, but maybe it's a helicopter. And, right. And the way that we're implementing it is we're trying to take it down the freeway as if it's a car. But maybe this is just a fundamentally different technology that does have the opportunity to fly to our destination, but we don't have the, you know, the language, the ability, the infrastructure necessarily to take advantage of it. I just don't know yet. I feel like, so I kind of live in both worlds a little bit, right? I see this huge opportunity acceleration and, but I also see that we just have real simple and, you know, burning problems to solve now.
Yeah, but here's the thing though. You're actually now talking about the concept of completely reimagining the healthcare delivery, right? It doesn't have to be the way that it is right now. It's very episodic in many ways, right? I mean, you get sick and you go in and see, you know, some sort of a medical professional. And I've always said this in the past. It's like, we don't have a healthcare system in the United States. We have a sick care system. Right. We really, yeah, healthcare is really when you're engaging with your health when you're still healthy. And so, but so it could do a variety of things, right? I mean, and just effectively self-agency as you, when you are navigating through sick care is definitely one of them. And, you know, I have obviously a personal experience in that one. And I used to remember saying that, like, here I was, you know, I kind of dealt with complex problems at that point in the corporate world. I managed, you know, very high performing individuals. And I remember going like, how does someone who doesn't have my skill set ever navigate through that system without having any knowledge, deep knowledge about this stuff. And so maybe in that sense, it's going to be fantastic, right? It's going to provide agency to a patient or a caregiver as they're navigating through that system. And the problems that come along with, you know, navigating chronic conditions.
Oh, and I know we only have a few more minutes together, but how do we kind of contrast that, Troy, and that potential you're talking about with how that fits in a regulatory framework and software as a medical device? Like, I know you're not there anymore, but like, how do we even start wrapping our heads around how we would get that, you know, helicopter different path with healthcare with current regulatory paradigms?
Well, I think you have to, in my opinion, look at this end-to-end thing, right? I mean, I always kind of looked at healthcare as a value chain from that starts with maybe you can look at different starting points, medical school, drug development, medical device development, and all through that. And regulation, in my opinion, is just one part of a critical milestone of bringing, you know, healthcare to the market itself. And so, you know, when I went into the government and my perspective of regulation were really just, I kind of said it's just a fancy way of saying guardrails. It's parameters where innovation needs to happen within. And there's not a single other industry that doesn't have those parameters. And sometimes those parameters are driven by laws of physics, and other times they're driven by something else, right? I mean, just like we have safety parameters when we're driving or aviation or whatever that may be. And so, regulation, in my opinion, should always kind of look at this thing and say, okay, what are the safety parameters that you have to establish in order to make sure that you're taking advantage of all of this innovation that is happening, but you're also reducing the risk of that. And so regulation shouldn't just be done or be considered by the government. The government's angle is about coming up with regulation, but it has to work with the industry, say, what are the common sense kind of guardrails that you have to establish? So, you know, when I was working in the government, that's the tack that I took to say that, you know, anything that we do here has to be effectively implementable by the industry itself, because if it can't be implemented, it's just a piece of paper at that point. And so, you know, we focused on things like life cycle management. Make sure that, you know, you truly understand how these things are not just developed, but integrated into healthcare system, how it's being, the value is being delivered, whether it's a standalone product or, you know, maybe through something like an EHR. And then how do you monitor this thing? And so, like, the biggest thing about generative use is that it continuously adapts, right? It's continuously learning. That's the main difference. And so that means that you have to have the monitoring capabilities that goes in with that ongoing learning process. I frankly, I come from the enterprise kind of software world, and it was kind of surprising to me that, you know, monitoring, whenever I would talk about monitoring, that people would look at me funny. I'm going, I don't ever remember releasing a piece of software without actually having monitoring capabilities. And why is this any different is the question that I would pose.
Well, welcome to healthcare, where no
Right.
software has monitoring capabilities.
Right.
Troy, thanks so much for coming on and being our inaugural guest to kick this off.
Thank you.
You know, unfortunately, we won't have time to hear all of Matt's wonderful comments on DeepSeek and everything it means for the field, but I think there are plenty of comments online that people can read about there. Thank you guys for joining us here. And if this is we're going to keep doing this for at least a few more times, and if this is interesting, let us know what we should cover.
It's always fun to have these discussions with you too. So I always enjoy it.
Good to see you, Troy.
Good
Thanks
seeing
for
you
joining
all.
us.